Good morning. Now, you might have thought the biggest budget in the history of the state would be the lead, but of course not. Now the question is, what level are we at? Because let's face it, it's hard to keep up. Wednesday evening saw level 4 status bestowed on border counties Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And for the rest of us, it was level 3 plus, with the plus being no household visits. But we all know what's coming. Level 5, lurking in the long grass. And yes, we're all getting a little ragged around the edges.
There's a great emoji. Do you know the one where the brain explodes with bits of your brain and bone and hair? That one? My head's heading down towards that because I don't... You know, so if I go and see my mother, is that because I'm being compassionate? Do I get away with that? Is that... But there's no law against it anyway. Or meet somebody outside? Are you... Can I go to the toy shop? Who am I? I don't understand.
Melty brains for Ryan, and Ray was putting on the runners.
The only analogy I can come up with is a marathon. You know, you're there, you've run 21, 22 miles, and, you know, then there's a hill. There's a hill. And you have to draw on every reserve of energy that you have to get up that hill. But you do, and you will, and you'll get there, and we'll all cross the line together, and we'll come out the other side.
Oh, and it is a marathon for sure, but weary as we may be, onwards. Because if we were in any doubt about just how high the stakes are, Brian O'Connell's report on Thursday from Cork University Hospital was a stark and chilling reminder of just how precarious our situation is. Here he is with Dr. Karina Sadlier, an infectious disease consultant in CUH.
So we're just swiping into the emergency department now, which is very busy. Some of these are isolation rooms that people have been assessed in and are awaiting a COVID swab. So
incredibly busy, as you said. Everybody is gowned up. Everybody's wearing visors, wearing masks.
So I'm looking at a room in here now. Obviously, there's somebody outside the room. The room is sealed and there's a video screen outside.
This is just to allow us to monitor closely patients who are in isolation for suspected COVID or with COVID. Each time a member of staff has to go in, they have to don and doff PPE. We need to be in contact with patients, but just that someone has eyes on them when they're not in the room.
So you can monitor the patient through this screen here without having to go into the room.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly isolatory disease, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very hard for patients. It's very hard for families. I mean, patients can be very frightened when they hear they have COVID. Unfortunately, increasingly, we're seeing the vulnerable groups, elderly patients who have isolated, who have cocooned over the last number of months, who just don't know how they got COVID infection. We've seen a steady increase in hospitalizations. Yes, it does tend to be older patients, vulnerable patients, who are getting very sick, but these are people that were living independently at home, that had a good quality of life, taking every precaution.
And as had always been the fear, it was the additional pressure this was placing on an already stretched health service that was the issue. Here's Rory O'Brien.
What's it like for you this morning, Rory?
So we're often having patients waiting in the waiting room who quite clearly need, you know, urgent and active treatment, and it's kind of leading to moral dilemmas on a daily basis.
Because this is what we've been hearing about. If the pressures come on our health services, these are the kinds of horrible decisions that people are having to make, and already some of those decisions are having to be made.
I mean, this is nothing new. So this is what we've been doing before COVID. COVID has changed the way we're streaming, and it's putting, I suppose, more pressure on the people who are trying to put patients in beds. There's definitely extra pressure. First look there, we have about 24 patients in the department in a 12 cubicle 4 resource bay department who need admission. And you can see actually there's nowhere to move patients into. So if we get an elderly frail person coming in through us, we can't assess them in the area that we had designed to assess them. Yeah, I think if we do get, well, we're in the midst of a second wave, but if numbers continue to deteriorate as they appear that they are, it's going to have knock-on consequences. And I think it's not so much for the patients with COVID, actually, it's for the patients who don't have COVID will suffer.
Brian O'Connell reporting from Cork University Hospital on Thursday. And later that same day, Chief Executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, spoke on the News at One. And he looked ahead to winter and acknowledged that some hospitals were under pressure.
for those people who need that intensive hospital care, what is the situation? There are still ICU beds available in the system, but some hospitals are already at capacity, aren't they? As of yesterday, there were no ICU beds in either of the main Cork hospitals. Other hospitals have no critical care beds available. The Mater and St Vincent's in Dublin, Mullingar, Tullamore, 9 in total. How concerning is that?
Yeah, we would be concerned because more hospitalisations no doubt will result in more ICU beds being taken up. And at a national level, if I can just give it to you, I'm happy to comment on any hospital, but at a national level, we have capacity of about 282 beds, 30 were put in place in the last few weeks and months. We do have what we call a surge capacity, so that's where we can build it up to about 350, 360. But it's important for your listeners to know, as we go into surge, two things happen. One, we're using high dependency unit beds and preoperative or postoperative theatre beds, so less procedures can take place once we go into surge. So we don't want to be going into surge. It draws on all of our other services. Right now, today, we have about 40 ICU beds across the system. Some individual hospitals that you just mentioned specifically would be starting to utilise some of their surge capacity. So in Cork, for example, they do have 20 ICU beds. They have a capacity to get up to Cork University Hospital, capacity to get up to 36. Mm-hmm. But they still do have two vacant right now at this moment in time. So you are seeing people moving through ICU.
The HSE's Paul Reid on Thursday's News at 1. Now, in a pretty hefty understatement, lockdowns are difficult. And when these new restrictions were announced on Wednesday evening, this texter into Late Debate wasn't quite in a glass half full mood. Here's Katie Hannan with Independent TD Fiona Murphy.
All this endless diet of hand washing, mask wearing and physical distancing is now becoming increasingly meaningless. Why should I bother anyway? I'm thinking of throwing in the towel. Even lockdowns don't work. We cannot go on like this. We just can't. I think there are many people out there tonight who will be have that weary, weary feeling of, you know, what's the point? What's the point of this? We're rolling from one lockdown to another. You're not a fan of lockdowns, Fiona.
No, I'm not. And I appreciate we're all politicians here. And I think there's one very big problem. I'm 8.5 months a politician, and I've seen us go from crisis to crisis to crisis. And all I see is crisis management. And what I want to see, and I'm sure what the people want to see even more than handouts, is crisis prevention. And we've had 7 months, 7.5 months now. We spent almost 3 months in lockdown, but I can't see any result. Like when Christopher says there's a plan of what closes. We have no plan of where we're going to prevent it. And I mean, you've got to have buy-in if that plan is to work. Like the World Health Organization has told us this week, lockdown is to buy us time to put preventative measures in place. I want to see for the country, for that person who's at the end of their tether, where's the plan to prevent lockdown the next time? We can't keep going to lockdown and ruining the economy. There are people driven over the edge tonight by this. And it's not the people just getting married. It's not the people. It's the people who know that they can't visit their people who are dying in nursing homes, coming to the end of their life. This just can't go on.
Fiona Murphy on lockdown on Wednesday's Late Debate. But the notion of developing herd immunity was shot to pieces by Professor Luke O'Neill, who spoke to Claire Byrne on Wednesday.
Sadly, there is evidence now growing that reinfection is a possibility.
I saw this. This is terrible news.
Well, I wouldn't, again, as an immunologist, I wouldn't worry because you see this. It's like what we call a normal distribution. There's a good phrase here. Some people will be reinfected. Some won't. Most are in the middle. They might get reinfected, but it'll be less troublesome for them. You know, it's the important thing. I suppose less severe. And that's a good thing.
Well, I remember you telling me before that your antibodies may die away, but your T cells will respond if the virus comes at you again. So where does that stand now if reinfection is possible?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So there should be some immunity. I mean, this is how the immune system is supposed to work. You know, you get protected. But with coronaviruses, like the common cold, people do get reinfected. But they will have milder disease next time, which is good, obviously. So there's a bit of, you know, built-in protection. They won't be as severe. But the truth is, you will see reinfections. They should, on average, be much milder, which is good. But the worry then would be they'll still be infectious, you see. And that's why we need the vaccine.
Ah,
the vaccine will stop all that.
So you might get a milder dose, but you could still be spreading it.
Yeah, exactly. That's why this notion of going for herd immunity is unacceptable to immunologists, because it'll just burn away forever at a low level in the community anyway, you know. So we can't really have that as a strategy. The only way out is a vaccine, really.
A vaccine we do not have, Professor Luke O'Neill. So where does that leave us? Well, as of yesterday, yet again, NPHET are looking at level 5. A breathless Barry Lenehan took the political temperature on Drive Time.
And the feeling from talking to those in government over the last 24 hours that the move to level 5 is thought to be inevitable. Preparations already in hand for what it entails, we're told. The surprise, though, in government buildings, the durations, 6 weeks, brings us into December.
OK, so what happens next?
More action needed, a meeting tomorrow, so says the Taoiseach.
Obviously, the government will give this very detailed consideration, examining all aspects of this and make sure that when we respond, it'll be a comprehensive response. You know, we take advice from NPHET very seriously. This is going to get very good consideration. You know, I don't want to put a timeline on it because government will have to meet. But in advance of government meeting, you know, we want to have the situation well documented, well prepared.
The Health Minister, though, Stephen Donnelly, is calling for certainty.
I'm not at all surprised at what the data is showing. We've known for some time that we have rising cases and it is exponential growth. Are we always looking at the potential for other levels within the framework? Of course we are. It is a 5-level framework. All of the levels are there for a reason to respond to this virus and get it back down. I don't want to preempt anything. I think what we know from previous events is that, as you say, uncertainty in individuals thinking about what may or may not happen. I don't think that's fair on people. I think what people need to know is what the current situation is.
Minister Stephen Donnelly on Drive Time yesterday. But as a reminder as to why, back to HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid, who wanted to pass on this message from frontline staff.
They are extremely anxious and they are calling out to me to call out. They don't really want to be this last line of defence. They really need us to put our defences up and protect them in the coming weeks and months. And yes, testing and tracing will help us. And yes, more bed capacity can help us, but it's a really big call to arms to the public to really get behind, put our defences up and protect our healthcare workers.
Paul Reid of the HSE on the News at 1 on Thursday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. There were lots of special lady moments on the radio this week. On Sunday evening, questions around visibility and unconscious bias were explored. First up, The Book Show, when Ricochet interviewed Lenny Goodings, the pioneering feminist publisher of Arago. And Rick asked, but didn't quite ask, this.
I like that in chapter 12 of your memoir, it's titled, Does Any Other Successful Publisher Get Asked Constantly If They're Still Necessary? And that, of course, is not the sort of question I would ask of you. However, it is probably one that you've heard over the years. Is Virago's mission different now than it would have been 30 years ago, given the nature of the amount of brilliant women that are being published?
The thing is, on the whole, women have not had a hard time getting published. I don't think that's ever been true, and I don't necessarily think it's true now. I mean, everybody finds it difficult to get published. What I'm trying to call attention to, and what Virago was doing right from the beginning too, is called attention to the reception and to what happens when you put a woman's name on the spine of a book, what the perception of that is. Is the perception that it's limited, that it's niche publishing? I've recently been thinking about the fact that we say, not when we say novelist, we usually mean male novelist, because if anything else we say, we preface it by woman novelist, black novelist, gay novelist, whatever. And I actually think one of the jobs that Virago and the Women's Prize for Fiction do is we call attention to that sort of unconscious bias. We say, look, this is by a woman. Let's think about what it's saying from a woman's perspective. Let us think that it could be as universal and not and as unlimiting as any novelist by any man. And I don't think we're really there yet. One of the things I think is, you know, do we think that the novel is the woman's form, so therefore is it denigrated because it's mainly a woman's form? But the other thing I really call attention to, and I think publishers really have to answer for this, what covers do we put on novels by women? And Naomi Alderman had this wonderful line. She said, just because I'm a woman, just because I have a vagina, doesn't mean I have to have a flower on my cover. And I thought that was great. And I think publishers do need to own up to that. I think there is a bit of pink for girls and blue for boys, and that's not okay.
That was Lenny Goodings on The Book Show. And unconscious bias was explicit in who you wouldn't see, namely ladies, if you happened to cross the Atlantic to New York City and stroll around Central Park. Sorry, that's not entirely accurate. There were some women on display.
Alexander Hamilton, Christopher Columbus, Frederick Douglass, William Shakespeare, and Beethoven, to name just a few. There's even a statue of a group of bears and a dog named Balto. But women in the entire park, sure, they're represented. Alice in Wonderland, Mother Goose, and Juliet clinging to Romeo.
Colm Flynn reporting on the History Show on how all of that is about to change with a new sculpture by Meredith Bergman, which celebrates the work of suffragettes Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Sojourner Truth.
To understand who these figures were, we have to go back in time to the Seneca Falls Convention, the very first women's rights convention in the United States, which took place in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. The convention had been organized by a local homemaker, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was a well-educated and politically active woman, and over 300 people attended her conference. On the second day, they signed a document of 12 resolutions, making it the first time in US history that women were officially demanding more rights. This was the birth of the women's rights movement. Susan B. Anthony was born in 1830 in Massachusetts. She was from an educated Quaker family, and she happened to meet Elizabeth Cady Stanton one day on the streets of Seneca Falls, and the two teamed up, together leading the powerful women's rights movement for almost half a century.
Well, their determination and their practicality, the variety of reasons for which they were fighting for rights, everything from a kind of indignant sense of entitlement to real suffering, real exclusion, slavery.
Meredith came up with a design for these two historical figures sitting at a table. But then a third figure was added. A woman called Sojourner Truth.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom.
Sojourner Truth was born in 1797 in New York, and when she was 11, she was sold into slavery, along with a flock of sheep, for $100. Over the next 20 years, she suffered sexual abuse and continual beatings. She fled from her master in 1926, and just 1 year later she went to court to challenge the legality of her son being sold into slavery, and in a landmark case, she was successful. She then became a traveling preacher and a women's rights activist.
So it's three women, Sojourner Truth, Anthony and Stanton, working together, sitting around a small table, in the midst of a conversation, and I tried to sculpt it in such a way that you have to decide what they're saying and what their attitudes to each other are and what they're going to do next. And you can kind of narrate it in your own head, but every time you pass it, you may come up with a different conversation. But to show women from completely different backgrounds, educational, economic, religious, racial, and to show them working together to make the world better, to change society.
From the History Show on Sunday. And the particular approach some women take to illness cropped up with Ryan Tuberty during the week. He'd read out a text from a woman who was about to get results to see if she had cancer. But she hadn't told anybody. She didn't want to bother people. But she did want someone to know and wish her well. Luckily, she was in the clear. But it did prompt this phone call from Claire.
It just kind of struck me how, I mean, probably as women, we're great at doing that, at not wanting to worry people. But I thought it was very lonely as well that that she was there by herself going through that. And thank God everything turned out well for her. I suppose I think we're good at just protecting people. It's just kind of a natural thing to want to not worry, whether it's your family or your friends. People don't tend to want to do that. So I can kind of understand as well, as kind of sad as it is, that somebody might might do, there's women out there that are probably doing it today. Sure. They're heading in for results, and they're not telling, they're not talking about it, which I understand. But it's still quite sad.
And Claire had had very recent first-hand experience of getting a bad diagnosis. 3 weeks ago, she'd gone to her GP with a lump in her breast, which led her to having a mastectomy.
Yes, it's hard. There's moments where it's very hard, and that's a personal thing as well of when it hits you. But the actual surgery itself, the doctors and the nurses are amazing.
When does it hit you?
For me, it was that the night, in the middle of the night in the hospital after the surgery. So, you know, those lovely drugs they give you in the hospital have worn off, and okay. You're just a little bit like, oh, God, is that what I look like now?
Can I ask you a personal and superficial question?
Yep.
How is your relationship with your mirror?
I suppose I honestly have tried to change my mindset now. So, like, when I see myself, instead of going what I've lost, I'm looking at that scar has given me a chance to see my children grow up. That scar has given me a chance to have wonderful memories over the years with my husband and my friends and my family. So, in a way, like, it's a sign of life.
What a brilliant
chance to live.
What a brilliant answer and approach to something that could have been a negative. You've completely flipped it.
I'm not like that all the time. Like, I'd be lying, and I don't, you know, there is moments where I go, God, you know, I feel it's hard, but like 90% of the time I'm really positive.
Well, that is an attitude to be admired. That was Claire with Ryan on Tuesday. Later in the week, writer Kathy Kelly chatted to Ray Darcy, and she talked about insecurity and, in particular, her new character's inner critic, which she had named Mildred.
You know that little voice in your head that says, you know, you're doing this wrong, or you're a total idiot. Yeah. I mean, my voice is turned up to 11, and that is a Spinal Tap reference. I thought I'd call her Mildred, and because it made it more fun. This is the first book I've written in the first person, so it was like I rather than she or he or whatever. And it makes it different. So I was able to channel a lot of my own inner critic. So, and I thought, let's call her Mildred. And, you know, they say if you have something that's annoying you, if you name it, you can, you know, control it. I still have failed to control my own Mildred. She can still be narky. She's actually given out to me now because I have wet hair and I have to beautificate myself for something I'm doing later. And she said, why didn't you do that earlier?
Why don't you tell her to F off?
I know. I know. Obviously, I'm far too late, like, as we all know. Yes. Don't laugh. No. To use rude words.
No, but we all do have that, you know. Like, people recognise it as you say it, this thing in our head that's going, you know, what are you at? You know, who do you think you are?
Why did you do that?
Shut up.
Don't
do that. Yeah, yeah. That's
but not,
human
I
nature.
I don't think everyone has it.
Do you not?
I don't know. I think there's normal people out there, you know.
Wait, what are you saying, that we're not normal?
We're sort of normal. We're normal.
I think it's part of the human condition to have negative voices in your head. Yeah.
And insecurity is the preserve of just women. Ray did not think so.
And is this a very female thing, I wonder? It's like, I must pretend everything is fine.
No, you don't have a monopoly on insecurity.
You're very empathic, Ray.
No, I'm not. What a ridiculous thing to say. Is this just a women's thing? Of course, men experience insecurity. Same as women.
I know that. I do know that, absolutely. But you know, I like to think that women experience it with knobs on, but I could be wrong there, you know. But not all men, you know. I mean, there was this concept that a woman looks in the mirror and she sees the things that are wrong, whereas a man looks in the mirror and he goes, gosh, God, I'm looking great today. Is that the case?
I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for all men. But that's not the case for me. I'm avoiding mirrors at the moment.
Oh, I think you'll find you're not alone on that one, Ray. That was Kathy Kelly on Thursday. But weight and women was the focus for Drive Time on Wednesday, and an unexpectedly sparky item. Writer and advice columnist Dolly Alderton had received a letter from a single mother of two working from home who was concerned she was, well, letting herself go, hitting the pies, and sure, you may as well drain the glass. Dolly's response? Essentially, go easy. We are in a global pandemic, after all. And this had prompted a small storm of controversy on social media. So much so that on Drive Time, Cormac and Sarah spoke to journalist Lisa Hand about how to manage those self-soothing adult treats.
I mean, I think that any sort of sensible woman knows that, you know, downing, you know, a large family-sized, you know, packet of cheese and onion every night, you know, followed by a half bottle of gin is not good. But I think what people need, what Dolly was spelling out on this is just the need at this particular time when everybody's anxiety and stress are through the roof, not to add extra stress by thinking that you have to, you know, to basically reflect the pictures you see on Instagram and, you know, that sort of fake world.
You think this was good advice, do you?
I think it was good advice for the times that were in it. And I mean, that's a difference.
Well, hang on a second. Like, I really have to take issue with this. But I genuinely know, because Dolly uses her public platform to give what seems to me to be health or medical advice. Now, I don't know if she's qualified in that regard. Maybe she is. But I think some of the advice is problematic. She says, the gentle anesthesia of a gin and tonic. Now, this lady has written in to say, when she's stressed, she takes a gin and tonic on a daily basis. A drink every day, no problem if it's within guidelines. But drinking when you're stressed, to relieve stress, is that not an alarm bell in terms of overindulgence?
Well, then I think the entire country must be deafened at the moment, because there must be alarms going on in almost every house.
I'm sorry, pardon? It's very noisy in here. Well, step up, Sarah.
She says quieten the chatter about calorie counting and rules.
Yeah, and she also makes the point.
Focus on the requirement.
I think you've had a good run, actually.
She says, focus on the requirement of your appetites and tastes.
What's wrong with that?
Is this for real?
What's wrong with that? Because she makes the point that toddlers, for example, eat intuitively. You never see a toddler leaving food on the plate because they think that's what a French woman would do. They leave food on the plate because they think that they're full. So she's saying somewhere along the line, we forget what it's like to just eat until we're full.
And if we start eating, and that's what she means by intuitively,
listening to our bodies a little bit and eating until we're full, rather than thinking how much should we eat, how little should we eat, focus on diet.
We would all love to be given free rein on this, but we know that the processed food industry laces products with sugar and salt, gives you a dopamine hit, and you become an addict.
Yeah, but you're missing the point of this. She is talking about, at a time of immense stress, women who are notoriously self-critical of themselves, you know, are adding to the burden of an already incredibly stressed life by saying, I've got to lose weight as well.
And last word on all of this, to Lise Hand.
What I liked about this was, in a world of, you know, fairly cruel things going on, it was just a little sliver of kindness and empathy. And I think that was special.
Lise, I liked it too.
You'd be kind and sensible. Kind and sensible.
Thank you for coming on and explaining, giving a message of hope and kindness in the studio.
And overindulgence.
Half word, of course, typical man.
Go those elasticated trousers. That was Drive Time on Wednesday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. And now to the budget. You didn't really think we'd avoid it, did you? Because against a backdrop of no-deal Brexit and the absence of a COVID-19 vaccine, the 2021 budget was a whiz-bang pop, coming in at almost $18 billion. Chocolate and a toy? But where were we getting the money from? And would we really need to pay it back? Maybe in a land far, far away, strange days and all that. Well, Claire spoke to Fergal O'Rourke, managing partner at PwC.
There's 20 years of economic orthodoxy is going to go out the window today. For the last 20 years, in the words of Charlie McCreevy, when I have it, I'll spend it. When I don't have it, I won't spend it.
Yeah.
That's turning on its head now. The minister who would have delivered a surplus this year of $2.5 billion is now going to spend 10 years surpluses in one fell swoop this afternoon. And that is the economic orthodoxy we now face. We've now got to, he's got a balancing act to do. He's got to project that he's, you know, really facing the future with confidence. But at the same time, he's got to borrow enough, but not too much. He doesn't want to be an outlier in Europe, because we're going to have to pay this money back in 7 years, 10 years time, or refinance at higher rates. So he's got to display that confidence. And it's not about big spend. It's about big ideas. now that the concept of fiscal space is shattered, he now needs to say these are the three or four big things we're going to do, and he's got to direct.
Is it about big ideas or is it about firefighting?
It should be about both, because we're not worried about fiscal space anymore. This 200 or 300 million the minister had to parcel out between tax cuts and welfare, that's gone now. Now it's about what are the things that we can spend in a very focused way that will make a difference to Ireland.
Fair enough, but what about paying it back? Well, Claire asked this of financial planner Owen McGee.
This is a really simplistic view, but I don't really understand why, when we have an international pandemic, everybody has to go into a black hole of debt to pay, to keep people alive and keep people in cash so they can eat.
Well, I think the main reason...
There's something wrong here.
Well, the main reason for that is because we can no longer turn on a printing press. We rely on Europe to turn on our printing press for us.
Europe to turn the thing
and,
on.
And this is exactly the point, Claire. There's a couple of points I'd make on that. First of all, 10-year bonds is right. There's a lot of people out there who are saying, just borrow the money. Like the NTMA went out last week and borrowed money at negative interest rates. So it's below zero. They're being paid. So that is a real option right now. But as Fergal says, in 10 years' time, the money has to be paid back. And who knows what the market will charge us if we want to refinance it again. There was the UK government, I think a year or two, I think it was 2017 actually, so a couple of years ago, paid back a 100-year war bond. So they have existed before. Ireland hasn't a chance of getting that on its own, but Europe does. Mm-hmm. Europe has a chance of getting a 50-year or 100-year bond. And roughly over a 50-year period, the value of money will halve if inflation stays as it is. So that makes it much more manageable that we just pay the interest rate. A 100-year bond you may not get negative interest rates on, but you'd expect you'd get it extremely cheap if Europe borrowed as a whole. We do have an ability here to borrow again. Think about it. We thought the deficit was going to be 30 billion. It's turning out to be 21. When it was 30 billion, we were told everything is fine. Everything's going to be OK. We'll be able to borrow that money. So it's only 21 billion now. So there is still some capacity.
Just turn on the printing machine. Oh, I do like Claire's style. But here comes Fergal O'Rourke with a bucket of ice cold water.
But will Germany, who have typically in the last 40 years dealt frugally with their economy, not really borrowed, produced huge surpluses, will Germany let the printing presses be turned on? I suspect this could be one of the battles that will define Europe for the next 20 years.
Eek. Well, on Wednesday, the new Chuckle Brothers, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, came into Clare Byrne. But first, we had Oliver Callan, who was in for Ryan, and he had had something of an awkward encounter.
Just before we went on air, I ran out to the lavatory and I ran headfirst into Pascal Donoghue. Not absolutely headfirst, obviously within 2 metres, but I wasn't wearing my mask and he was surrounded by lots of the big wigs in RT who are welcoming in for the big phone-in at 10 o'clock with Clare Byrne, and I wasn't wearing my mask. And I suddenly felt like a little child that I was caught, you know, out of class in school. So I just said, "Hello, Minister," and just ran away. "Good morning, Oliver." He's the only man who can kind of intimidate you in a very cheerful way. "But I'll be on to take your calls this morning. So ask whatever you like. I'll make the budget sound nice and dimple." Oh, did I say dimple? Diddums, diddums.
And dimple he did. So many callers disgruntled and annoyed and handled as smoothly as a baby's bottom. On Monday night's Arena, Sean Rocks spoke to writer and musician Paul Morley. The former NME darling became famous by eviscerating difficult second albums and defining musical cool. But now, Morley has written about discovering a love of classical music. But first, he had to get past the jargon.
It was like symphony and concerto and sonata. For a long time, I have to admit, were quite intimidating because I thought, if I don't know what they are, I don't know how I can start listening to the music. Eventually, I must admit it took a long time, I begin to realise that it just means a collection of instruments. It just means a certain form. It just means that this is the context of the story of the piece of music is in. And I became less intimidated by what I felt were a sort of a kind of language that was keeping me from something. So I guess what I had to do was work it out for myself. And create my own history.
But Morley had flirted with classical music in the past via his own band Art of Noise and Debussy.
Thank you. Imagine an actor saying the following.
Imagine me saying the following. When Debussy died on March the 25th, 1918 in Paris, it was being bombarded by the Germans, and it was raining.
That's Il Pleure, the opening movement of Art of Noise and the Seduction of Claude Debussy. I bring that up, Paul, because obviously you were part of Art of Noise at one level, that's one part of it, but Debussy seems to have been a big love for a long time in terms of classical music.
I always felt that that period of French music at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, I certainly decided to take it as the beginning of all modern music. I felt that what certainly Debussy, Ravel and Eric Satie were doing at the time was a kind of preview of using the recording studio, even though the recording studio hadn't yet been invented. And they wrote music as if they were using the recording studio, which made it incredibly modern. They almost learned how to do overdubs, how to smear sound, how to make sound exist for its own sake. And so that Art of Noise album, The Seduction of Claude Debussy, was part of my attempt to sort of follow this research through. You know, I always like to do things that help me with my own education, like make a record, write a book, find out for myself. And certainly that was an attempt to sort of draw the map of 20th century music that begins with Debussy and leads to things like Miles Davis. It leads to ambient music and in many ways leads to all sorts of popular music in terms of the way that you can draw a line from what he was doing to where we are now.
Paul Morley with Sean Rocks on Arena. And the power of music to move and compel could be heard on Bowman on Sunday, and the continuing exploration of the work and influence of composer John F. Larche.
Well, my mother was anxious that I would be very interested in music, but I'm afraid I disappointed her there.
Yes.
Because my voice was never a particularly good one. But I heard, perhaps at the age of 8 or 9, I was brought to a performance of Tannhäuser. Mm. And the Tannhäuser, you know, in the end of the overture, that wonderful theme of
the pilgrims
theme,
yes,
and blazoned out on the trombones and horns, that caused so much excitement to me that my mother became alarmed at the sort of hysteria. But that performance did one thing for me. It made up my mind very definitely that music was to be my life for the rest of time.
John F. Larche and that continuing series on Bowman on Sunday. On Monday, Claire Byrne spoke to Chris Carthy about literacy and the difficulties she had faced in her daily life without the skills of reading and writing.
And what pushed you then at the age of 46 to say, I am going to do something about this now?
Well, I had worked with people with special needs, and they were meant so much to me. They meant my life to me because they gave me so much. And when health and safety came in, we had to fill in forms, which was for different products. You know, they were changing all the products, like bleach and all that wasn't going to be used around the people. So I didn't know when the forms come up what was what. And panic used to set in. I had to start hiding bottles and putting them away in the cupboard. And then when the forms come up, I could spell off the bottle. But that only could last me for so long, you know. Things got more difficult then. I didn't have a clue, you know, if I had to fill in other forms or if there was a party and you had to sign a card for somebody leaving and you really liked them and you wanted to say something nice to try and get out of that, you know, not signing the card.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of things. Like, I couldn't go away with people because I'd be afraid if I got lost. Because of the signs, I might be standing under a sign and, you know, and know that's the sign, but I wouldn't know that's the sign for wherever, the B&B or the pub that I was supposed to be in, or, you know, I'd be afraid. I'd always make excuses. I couldn't go, or, you know, to gatherings or get-togethers like that, or go for dinner.
And now, having learned to read and write, Chris talked about how her life had changed.
The last 2 years, I have a smartphone. I have a computer. I got ill in March. I was able to look up my medication. I was able to talk to the doctor. I wasn't afraid to say, look, listen, I don't understand. I'm so happy. My life is so different. So different. It's brilliant.
Literacy student Chris Carthy with Claire on Monday. Now, yesterday, Morning Ireland, national intake of breath.
And just when you thought 2020 couldn't get any worse, last night came the news that Fungi, the famous dingle dolphin, was missing.
But all round, Fungi had returned. Here's Sean McEntee.
Late last night, word filtered through that a fisherman who had returned from the seas last night had spotted Fungi on his way back into the harbour, further out in Dingle Bay. There's a lot of dolphin activity out there at the moment. And yeah. Paul Hand has said that perhaps Fungi followed the fishing boats out, met the group of dolphins feeding out there, and it was enjoying the company. Now, another theory of thought is that Fungi is quite a solitary creature. He likes to be alone, and that when he detected other dolphins in his waters, that he's gone into hiding, or I suppose in the times we're
Sean,
in, that he's self-isolating.
I have to ask the stupid question. There's lots of bottlenose dolphins around. How do you know Fungi from the others?
Well, speaking to Paul Hand this morning, he's been fishing the Dingle waters for the last 40 years, and he's been looking at Fungi for the last 40 years, and he's got specific markings on his back. And
is
that
it the
you
way
know,
he
from,
might look at you?
It's the way he might look at you, and you know he has certain habits in how he follows boats and that, you know.
Oh, Mary, those mornings are suiting you, and Fungi is back, and all is right with the world, frankly. I don't know that we could have taken it. That is almost it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And if you're listening, Fungi, and I know you are, this is for you.
La mer, qu'on voit danser